Global politics have been thrown into question with the inauguration of America's current president, who in some aspects exhibits the egomania and narcissism of North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Another president, George W. Bush, called North Korea a rogue nation, and with its nuclear potential, it remains a perplexing dilemma for the rest of the world. I'm Suzanne Lang with KRCB's A Novel Idea. Today we look at the human effects that totalitarianism, propaganda, and fear have on North Koreans. I thought it might be good to revisit Wendy E. Simmons, whose travel memoir, My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest, Worst Place on Earth, chronicles her recent visit to this strange country. We'll listen to an excerpt from my conversation with her a little later in the broadcast. Coming right up is my conversation with Paul H.B. Shin, who has written a political thriller, Half-Life, with very human characters, elite North Koreans who struggle to protect themselves and their families in the face of a paranoid, tyrannical regime. It's all ahead. It's North Korea. It's a novel idea. Paul H.B. Shin is an award-winning journalist whose most recent work is with ABC News. He was born in South Korea and lived in London during much of his childhood. Half-Life is his first novel and is set in 1997, during the period when famine was devastating North Korea and there were a series of high-profile defections. Here is our conversation. Paul H.B. Shin, welcome remotely to Sonoma County. Hopefully you'll visit us here sometime soon.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Suzanne.
We're here to talk about your novel, Half-Life, and we will do that, I promise. This is your first published novel after a career as a journalist, and I wanted to ask you about that. I wanted to ask you about your career in journalism and then moving into writing a novel. Has that always been your direction, and how did that prepare you for writing fiction?
Certainly, yeah. I have always aspired to write a novel since I was a kid. And one of the reasons that I actually went into journalism was so that I could write about real things happening in the world. It took a long time to write this particular novel, but I'd been sort of gathering yarn for this particular book for many years, and so I finally buckled down and wrote it.
And yes, there's lots of yarn out there when it comes to talking about North Korea. You're writing in the time frame of your book is the 1990s.
That's correct.
A lot of nastiness going on then as now.
Right. There was a particular reason that I set the novel in the year 1997. What was going on in North Korea was that there was a devastating famine that was so severe that it was actually shaking the foundations of the ruling class. So in that same year, there were a bunch of high-profile defections of North Korean officials, including the man that is widely credited for the founding principle of North Korea, which is a concept called juche, which is self-reliance. So a Western journalist likened his defection to a James Madison or a Thomas Jefferson defecting to King George, and it was the magnitude of the defection was that great. So that's why I based this novel in that particular year, because there were a lot of very interesting things going on in North Korea and in its relation to the outside world.
So there is a factual element to the setting of this story with some of those characters involved. And it sounds like some of those defections took place because they saw the handwriting on the wall for themselves.
That's right. In North Korea, when you're sort of pushed to the outside of the power structure, it's actually not just an issue of losing your position, but it can be a fatal decision as well, as we saw quite recently, actually, with North Korea's new ruler, Kim Jong-un. He ended up executing somebody who was a very close advisor who was sort of pushed to the outside of the power structure. So when you get pushed on the outside in North Korea, it's not just a matter of losing your job. You can actually lose your life as well.
And it can happen at all levels, really.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, and the ruler is considered infallible, so his decision is basically it's basically gospel.
There's almost this deification that is held up pretty well. And
that's right.
Yes.
Whenever you see Western journalists go into North Korea and they make an effort to interview quote-unquote regular people, it's not quite clear whether those regular people are sort of espousing the party line because they feel that they have to save their own lives, or whether they actually believe in that, whether they actually believe that propaganda. My suspicion is that it's a little bit of both. That they're this cult of personality, and that they actually believe some of the propaganda, but at the same time, I think a large percentage of the population also feels that they have to say this to basically keep themselves safe.
Well, that brings us right in into your novel, which has three primary protagonists.
That's correct, yeah.
A Westerner, Avery, and then Han, who is the main character who kind of presents the central conflict, and then kind of his colleague, Park.
That's right.
And then there are some women characters in the book as well who present kind of a moral influence on these male characters. But Han, he's working in the United States, and his wife and small child, baby, disappear. They are not at home when he comes home one day. And
yeah, that's right.
And so that kind of sets that part of the story in motion. But these three men really do present facets of this situation in North Korea.
That's correct. Actually, that's a pretty incisive unraveling of the story. These three characters represent different aspects of what's going on and also represent different viewpoints. Han, the main character, is propelled into this. The story is propelled by the fact that Han's wife runs away with their newborn son. So I guess that's what in literature class you would call the inciting incident. So that's what sets the story in motion, but the story is actually driven by the lifelong decisions of Han and his wife and the characters that surround him, and is driven forward by their decisions, their characters. And for people who may be listening, this is ostensibly a spy thriller, but it's sort of in the tradition of a John le Carré or a Graham Greene. It's not really a sort of a techno spy thriller, as they call it.
No, and at its heart, it's a very human story, and with this very strong political undercurrent that I think has relevance today. In fact.
Yes, I believe that as well. And, you know, there's plenty of fiction out there that works purely on the level of fantasy, and I'm a very big fan of that kind of fiction. But I personally wanted to write something that is squarely grounded in reality, with recognizable landmarks, both emotionally and in terms of the political structure that people could recognize. And actually, some of the input that I've gotten from readers after reading this book is that they learned quite a bit about North Korea from reading the novel, even though my intent wasn't necessarily to educate people. My primary intent is to tell a good story. But because North Korea hasn't really been written about much in this sense, people told me that they had learned a lot of things about North Korea that they weren't aware of.
I think it's very difficult for people to understand that level of control and allegiance to that control that is exercised on people, so that even when these characters are in the United States, they are still subject to this rigid control that is largely based on fear and protection of their lives and the people who are back in North Korea while they're in the United States.
Right, absolutely.
I think that's a really hard thing for us to grasp, though maybe we'll be grasping it more and more. I'm not sure.
Right, right. I hope that one of the kind of objectives in terms of this particular story, one of the things that I set out to tell was that kind of emotional paranoia that officials in North Korea feel, and tell the story in a way that people in the West would be able to understand. Because most of the time when we hear about North Korea in the news, it's usually some kind of strange antic of the North Korean leader, or it's either that or the North Korean nuclear program, and the kind of periodic saber rattling that it does with its geopolitical neighbors. So we really don't get to see the sort of the inside lives of the people who have to put up with that kind of duality of living in that kind of reality. But if you're a high-ranking North Korean official, you also get to travel abroad, so you see what the Western world is like. So you kind of have to reconcile those very two different worlds all the time. And I kind of wanted to get into what it must be like for somebody to live that kind of lie for their entire lives.
Yes, and then when they are in this country, both Park and Han experience it quite differently, actually, but still with that same kind of rigid allegiance to their leader and their culture, or what's left of their culture, I should say.
Yep, that's right.
And Park chooses to indulge, and Han does not. I found that an interesting juxtaposition that almost, and I don't want to give a lot of the trajectory of the story away, but Han is continually faced with his own reflection of really the differences between America and, or where he's living now, which is America, and North Korea. I think this whole episode causes him to go maybe more deeply within and indulge in that kind of self-reflection than he has ever done in his life before.
Right, most certainly. He's kind of forced into that self-reflection because his wife has run away. So he has to think about what it was that caused his wife to run away. And it sort of transcends the level of a domestic incident, because in this particular case, if a North Korean official's wife and child run away, then not only does it become an international incident, but it could be very dangerous both for him and his surviving family in North Korea. So it causes him to really look back on what is it that he did to trigger this incident.
And we'll mention that he and his wife have a small daughter that is behind in North Korea, which complicates the situation all the more.
That's correct.
Paul, you grew up or were born in South Korea?
That's correct, yes.
And do you remember it much?
Yes, I was actually there until I was quite old, into my college years. But when I was younger, my father was worked for a company that sent him to England. So the family lived in England for several years when I was younger. So I had that experience of traveling around in culturally very different countries and sort of feeling, I guess, at an early age, the kind of curiosity about why cultures are the way they are, how they're different, and in some sense a kind of alienation at an early age, trying to figure out, you know, how does one belong to one's peer group, that kind of thing. You know, some of that, I guess, is in the novel Half-Life, that sense of alienation, because the characters Han and Park, they're working abroad in a very different, and in this particular case, a very country that is hostile to their own country. So they have to deal with that in some way.
Now, I recall there was, I think it might have been Han who made this observation, or one of the characters did, that at some point, the generation of people that recalled a unified Korea would all be gone, and that those of a certain age would not remember that these two countries at one time were unified. And I couldn't help but to think about that then, that could be a reality. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure thing, yeah. Well, the generation that remembers the Korean War, or perhaps even the years before the Korean War, they are very elderly now. They are on the verge of dying out. Every once in a while, periodically, there'll be some effort to reunite families that have been separated by the war. And it's always a very sort of tragic thing when you see these elderly brothers and sisters see each other again, and they only remember each other as very young children, and then they get together and then they hold each other and they start crying, and these events are often nationally televised. And it's a really heartbreaking thing. You know, in the case of East and West Germany, when they were reunited, it was a sort of shocking event, but I would venture to say that if North and South Korea are reunited, it would be much more sort of groundbreaking and momentous, because the countries have been separated for so long and there was no sort of back and forth communication between the two countries as there was between East and West Germany. And there are some sociologists who have said that once people have been separated for more than 50 or so years, that they essentially become two different countries. So at some point it becomes quite difficult, I think, for two countries to kind of reconcile and become reunited.
I sometimes wonder about the people of North Korea who have been so sheltered and so lied to. I guess what happens to a psyche of a society, and is there an easy recovery from that? I'm not sure. That sense of betrayal, almost, I would think people would feel.
That kind of gets to the ending of the novel, which I won't give away, but that really sort of sums up, I think, the sort of final chapter of Half-Life. And I think in terms of whether they will be able to adapt, it's still an open question. I'm sure they will, should the outside world pour into North Korea. But right now, there are, from the last article that I read, there are actually only four or so, like a handful of internet servers in North Korea, all controlled by the government. This compares to like thousands and thousands in the U.S., of course. So there are only a handful of entry points for the internet into North Korea, and those are very tightly controlled by the government. So I don't think people in the West and people in industrialized countries can really grasp the kind of closed-off society that North Korea really is. I think it would be really hard to imagine the kind of isolation that they're experiencing.
And that they may or may not comprehend it themselves.
That's right. You don't know what you're missing, right?
Yes.
Until you see it.
Yes. Right. And so getting back to the book, Han does see it. I mean, he had experiences in the Soviet Union. I mean, he went to school in Moscow. Mm-hmm. He then is stationed in New York City, but he cannot legally go beyond a certain perimeter. And so
That's right.
In his quest to find his wife, he manages to migrate out a little bit further from New York City and observes the wider culture in a way.
Right.
And he then reflects back on the large freeways in North Korea that have nobody driving on them, and the edifices that don't seem to have any people in them.
For him, it's that venturing out of that zone, that legal zone, is also an eye-opening incident because in some ways, people who are in New York, this is what he thinks, is that he can kind of consider it a fake Potemkin village that's been this kind of facade that's been created for the benefit of the outside world, because this kind of thing happens in North Korea where they create entire villages where everybody's happy and everybody's standard of living is really high. So because he's familiar with that level of manipulation, he in some ways, I mean, in his true heart, he knows that it's not true, but he kind of has to hang on to the illusion that perhaps it's not true so that he can kind of keep his sanity, that maybe New York is fake, because if it were real, what would that really mean? It means that America is this colossus that could run them over at any moment. So he kind of hangs on to this illusion, but once he goes beyond that perimeter, it's harder and harder for him to hang on to that illusion. And in places like North Korea, I think a lot of the very wide roads, they're known for very, very nice roads, in fact, very nice roads, and there are all these huge public works projects and very elaborate buildings. But people who have visited those areas say that it's almost like this abstract architecture or abstract sculpture that's there for the benefit of boasting about the engineering prowess of the country rather than built for some kind of utility. So he's used to that kind of sort of illusory engineering projects and public infrastructure. So when he goes beyond that boundary, it becomes harder and harder for him to kind of believe that that all of this created in New York City was for his benefit and for the benefit of, to pull the wool over the eyes of the outside world.
And in your book, the small daughter that Han and his wife left behind in school, she is subject to some of that rigid schooling. And Han's wife, I think it scared her. And that was partly why she needed to make a move.
Right.
Yes.
Right. The in the schools in North Korea, as you can imagine, the indoctrination starts very early, and they are told to honor the dear leader or the great leader or whoever the leader may be, to revere the reader above all else, including their own parents. So the main character's wife, Han's wife, encounters an aspect of this during a trip back to North Korea, to Pyongyang. And it becomes this chilling incident for her, and one of the reasons that she decides to make this very fateful decision to defect.
Yes, that she can save one of her children, mm-hmm. Yep. I think was her motivation. And
that's
we won't give too many of the details away here, but I do want to talk just quickly about the structure of your book, which seems to unfold in a way, and you really have control of the revelation of the characters and the pacing, which, as you get into the book, it's kind of a nail biter. So how did
I appreciate that? Yep, thank you very much.
And yet, there's this real—I'll say almost a sadness or a heartbreaking quality with this tension and sense of danger. So how did you play with all that?
I worked on this book for over 10 years, and I knew that it would be very hard to keep up momentum and keep up the kind of consistency of tone that I would need over that long time. I knew when I started this that it would take a long time, partly because, you know, I was working a day job and partly because of the research. But I understood when I began this novel that it would be a long haul. So I wanted to give myself a bit of a roadmap that I could follow when I got stuck, when I encountered writer's block. So I decided to write an outline, and in the outline, which was approximately maybe about 20 pages, I basically outlined the general arc of the story, the major plot points, including some of sort of the emotional arcs that I wanted the main characters to travel. That basically served as my guideline in terms of pacing, in terms of character development. And, you know, after I finished the first draft, I moved some things around. But that really served me well, I think, in terms of keeping a consistent tone and keeping some momentum with the book.
I thought it was a pace that allowed the reader to see the movement, the emotional movement of
right.
of the characters.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. That was one of my major goals, was to have the story unfold because of the decisions that the characters make, instead of relying on some deus ex machina kind of plot points that would just drive the story along. Because I think readers feel a little bit cheated when that kind of thing happens. So I wanted not only the story to be grounded in reality, but also the emotions to be grounded in reality.
Well, that they are. And Paul H.B. Shin. Hey, is the H.B. Something I wouldn't be able to pronounce because it's part of your Korean name?
Quite possibly, yep. It's my Korean name. It's Hyun Bong, H-Y-U-N-B-O-N-G. That's my Korean name.
Ah, okay. Well, Paul H.B. Shin, Half-Life is the book. Thank you so much for talking to us today, and I wonder if there's anything you'd like to leave us with on the book or on the situation in North Korea or the situation
sure
in America.
Yeah. Well, you know, the story is set in 1997, but I think a lot of these themes are still very current. As a matter of fact, earlier this year there was a North Korean official based in London, the number two guy, who defected with his family. He happened to be stationed in London with his immediate family. So he actually defected, which kind of brought out some of the same themes that are handled in this book. So if you've been curious about North Korea, but really haven't found an entry point to kind of learn more about it, and more importantly, if you're looking for a sort of traditional espionage thriller that's based on characters, then I would urge you to give it a try, give Half-Life a try. And you can learn more about the book on my website. It's paulhbshin.com. That's paulhbshin.com.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay. Thanks, Suzanne.
My conversation with Paul H. B. Shin. His book is Half-Life. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Some of you may recall that earlier in the year, we featured Wendy E. Simmons, who spent 10 days in North Korea, and it blew her mind in a way she did not anticipate. Here is an excerpt from that conversation. You can hear the full version online. Wendy E. Simmons, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
You're here with your lovely book, My Holiday in North Korea, the funniest and worst place, or I should say the funniest slash worst place on earth. And we're going to talk about the funny and the worst. You are a traveler.
Yes.
You might have a career, but it seems like your career is to support your true identity as a traveler and a solo traveler. You've done lots of solo traveling.
I have.
You decide you're going to take a trip to North Korea. How did that evolve?
Well, I really do try to go everywhere by myself. So it was without question that I wanted to go there alone. And, you know, like the decision I make to go anywhere, it was random. I have no methodology. Something will just pop in my head and I'll decide to go. And I really crave unique experiences. And this certainly delivered. And as silly as it's going to sound, I had heard a couple of people talking about North Korea within maybe, you know, a week or so time. And I got this very silly notion in my head that it was on the precipice of becoming normal. So I thought, I've got to get there quickly before it does. So the idea popped in my head to go. And within a couple of weeks, I went. And, you know, I remember I spoke to the agency in China about going, and they were very discouraging initially of me going by myself. It's not done very often. And I understand more so why now, having been. And, you know, but I really kept saying I really want to go by myself, and I wanted to go longer than most people because that's the way I travel. I like to spend enough time in each place that I really get a feeling for it. And it was that simple. I just got the idea and I went.
It seems like this trip turned out to be challenging in ways maybe you didn't anticipate.
Oh, I didn't anticipate it at all. I could never have imagined. You know, I go on lots of trips that are physically demanding. You know, the conditions are sparse, or, you know, I've seen tons of poverty. I've seen everything. And this was emotionally very difficult for me. I've never been on a trip where I cried, you know, all the time. And, you know, I'm a pretty strong individual. And you know, you have to, I guess like a doctor, you have to develop a certain amount of immunity to the conditions that you see around the world. And, you know, it was a combination of the poverty and, but more than anything, it was just the lack of free will that people have there. It's so shocking, and it's something you hear about and read about, perhaps, but you can't fully appreciate how awful it is until you're there. And it was confusing. It was depressing. The people I was with, my handlers, I just felt so sad for. It's just, you're so full of conflicting emotions. And at the same time, for me at least, I was aggravated and annoyed. I couldn't get any answers to anything. So I was just awash with conflicting emotions, and I hadn't anticipated how difficult it would be to be there for so long in those circumstances.
You share that with us very candidly in the mm-hmm. book, and I'll remind our listeners that the book is My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest Worst Place on Earth. And I'm speaking with Wendy E. Simmons, the author, and the book is filled with a lot of photographs that Wendy took on the trip. It's a congratulations. It's a really nicely done book.
Thank you so much.
You really do pull us into your emotional state and the way you related with your handlers. And you actually, and why don't we talk about your handlers?
Sure.
and tell our listeners who they are and your relationship to them while you were there, and maybe some of the context of what mm-hmm. traveling in North Korea is like these days.
Sure. So you, when you go to North Korea, you are not ever alone. You are assigned government minders. I call them handlers because that's basically what they do. And whether you are alone, as I was, or with a group of, 20, 50, 100 people, you are assigned two handlers and you have a driver. And you are not ever without them unless you are in your hotel room alone at night. That's it. I wasn't allowed outside of my hotel without them. I wasn't allowed to go to the bathroom when I was outside of my hotel without them. I was with them from the moment they picked me up at the airport until the moment they deposited me back. And because I was by myself and there for 10 days, I developed a relationship with these two women. And, they are, unlike the majority of North Koreans, they're the elite 10%. And obviously they are, really at the top of the food chain because they're allowed to interact with foreigners. And as a result, their bubble is burst. They have, they're the most, the smallest group of people who have any idea that there's anything going on outside of North Korea that's different than the rhetoric that they've been told their entire lives. So they're in a very difficult position. I liken it in the book to the prisoners in Alcatraz that could hear the normal life back in San Francisco back in the day. Everyone else in North Korea has zero access to the internet, no outside information whatsoever, 100% propaganda. So whether or not they have some inkling that something's going on, they have no way to verify that. Whereas my handlers are interacting with Westerners on a regular basis. So they are hearing from me that life outside is a million times better than what they've been told and the life that they're leading. So as a result, I think they were trying to navigate this very delicate balance of needing to ensure that I believed that it was the greatest place on earth, convincing themselves that it's the greatest place on earth, and yet somewhat envious and upset by the fact that I was telling them differently.
And it sounds like you did not always respond with a smile and a thank you. Like in Lonely Planet,
yeah.
they cover North Korea,
mm-hmm.
but they do suggest just kind of being polite about things. And it sounds like you may not have always followed those Lonely Planet instructions.
I tried, and I really, everywhere I go in the world, I really do try to be respectful of the culture, and I think largely I succeed. But it was so hard in North Korea. I was so frustrated because they're so blatantly dishonest. They answer questions in a completely inane or illogical way. They will outright ignore you if they don't like the question you're asking. They lie. And, there's an example in the book where we stood outside one day in the rain and my older handler said, "It's a nice sunny day." This is just not very easy to let go. Maybe more so in the beginning, but by day 8, you're like, "You got to be kidding me. It's pouring." And, I went there like I go to any country to foster communication and understanding, and you're denied all chance of that. And so, I kept saying to them, "I don't understand why you have us here if there's no discourse. What's the point of tourism? What's the point of you and I even being together if we're not here to learn about one another?" And, the point is they want money from tourism dollars, not to necessarily learn anything about each other's culture. No one asked me any questions. Fresh handler would sort of sneak them here and there when we go to the bathroom. But by and large, not one person asked me anything.
As you said, they took you to a lot of different places.
Yes.
And some of it sounded pretty darn weird. And, and for a country that in the photographs, they have a lot of buildings mm-hmm. and big things and big statues.
Yeah.
But the opportunity to actually see real people doing real things seemed like it was being almost kept from you.
They do their best to present the propaganda tour and nothing more. And, you know, if you saw something normal, it was by accident. It was a mistake. And, you know, they'll take you to the hospital, for example, and it supposedly is the normal hospital, but the, you know, you don't see any patients. All the patients just went home. You just missed all the patients. Or, you know, they took me to a factory, and when we arrived at the factory, it had unexpectedly lost power 5 minutes earlier, and all 4,998 people had just left, and two had remained behind to make the biscuits. You know, it was this kind of craziness. So they would take you to real places, only there was nothing real about it. There was never anyone anywhere we would go. For example, we went to the Fun Fair, which is their extraordinarily depressing amusement park. And when we arrived, you know, there wasn't a soul in the amusement park. And within 5 minutes of arriving, a crowd of like 1,000 people showed up, and they were all adults and military professionals. And, you know, supposedly this is a spontaneous occurrence. They just all happened to arrive right then. So, but, you know, just walking down the street and seeing normal people hanging out on sidewalks or doing normal things that you would see in a city does not occur. It just does not occur. And if by chance you saw kids hanging out or something, it was almost like the Truman Show. It was a mistake, you know, and they would quickly scramble to fix that mistake. Anything else was staged, largely.
I imagine in a country where so much of the message is controlled, that didn't even dawn on them that you would think anything was weird about suddenly a flash mob, and it was the same one that appeared there or whatever.
Well, that was the crazy thing. I kept thinking, how dumb do they think I am? You know, and I would just think, am I crazy? Like, would a country go to this much trouble to do this for me?
One person.
Like, how much effort did this take? So that was another one of the conundrums, you know, that sort of internal conflict of, am I an egomaniac thinking that they would go to this much trouble for me? Or are they this off the wall that they would? And there's a story I tell, for example, about the football game that they took me to. It was a Monday morning at 9 a.m. football game. On the Sunday before, at about 5 in the afternoon, they learned that the event that I had scheduled for 9 a.m. the next day had been unexpectedly canceled, and it was one of the choices, and I chose it, and there was a flurry of phone calls to make this happen, and my handler turned to me and said, "You're so lucky. There just happens to be a football game tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., which seemed very odd time for a football game, and when I arrived, there was no one in the stadium, maybe 40 people, and we're talking like a regular-sized stadium. And my handler said, "I'm so sorry, there won't be very many people here because it's 9 a.m. on a Monday." And then halfway through the game, a giant crowd of people arrived. And all I could think about was, well, they must have had to make a lot of phone calls to get these people to show up for the game they staged for me. But on the other hand, you know, would a country really go to all that effort to make me believe that they have football games that normal people come to? It just seems so preposterous. But you can't put anything past a country whose sole mission it is to convince the people who live there and anyone who comes that it's the most fabulous place on earth and that the great leader's a genius. You know, this is the sole mission of the propaganda tour. So in that vein, why wouldn't they?
Tell us a little bit about Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and then Kim Jong-un. Who is the current great leader.
Right, the grandson.
And that they are almost looked at as deities there.
They are literally looked at as deities. At least the grandfather, Kim Il-sung, is. They abolished religion when Kim Il-sung came to power. And he's called the eternal leader. So the people believe, I mean, to what extent, I don't know. I can't get in people's head. But what you're explained is that he and his son, Kim Jong-il, are looked at as still running the country even though they're dead. And the tall tales, all religions have some aspect of tall tales, depending on what you believe and don't believe. But, you know, they'll tell you that they were writing in, you know, full sentences, writing novels like Dostoevsky at age 2, and that they make the sun rise and the stars appear in the sky, and the most extraordinary stories. And that not only is he the leader of the country from his deathbed in the mausoleum, but also literally God and literally the sun, as in the thing that shines in the sky. And, you know, so they're revered in a way that is difficult for people who live in a democracy such as ours to understand. So it would be sort of as if you were absolutely in love and enamored of the president and believed he should have all the power in the world, and also believed he was God and Jesus Christ and every other thing that you might possibly believe in. So it's very cult-like in that regard. And you know, again, you have to try to imagine living in a world where you have no access to outside information whatsoever. So you are told these things from the day you understand Korean. You know, that's all you're taught in school. That's all that's on television. That's all that's on the radio. That's what your parents tell you. And you're under the threat of death if you don't believe these things. So it's very much like a cult in that regard. And therefore, it's not that the people are dumb or crazy. It's that that's the only information they hear. They live in a bubble, truly, truly in a bubble.
The iconography, which is, as you said, everywhere, I found really interesting. Also, the what in the book you call, I think, cognitive dissonance, which I was seeing everywhere as well. But the children were walking around with these backpacks on that, like, had Mickey Mouse and Kitty.
Hello Kitty.
And I just thought, these are things that they don't have any idea. So it's almost like there's no signification to these things,
mm-mm.
Which I just found so ironic in a way that there they are with Mickey Mouse backpacks on.
Yeah, it's just stuff that came, you know, that they were given to them to put their school books in. It has no relevance. But what's interesting is that I had encountered these two tourists from Canada who were only there for 2 days, and I met them at the DMZ, and they had conflated the Disney backpacks with an openness that North Korea had, and had said to me that they couldn't believe how open and great North Korea was. They were so surprised that they even had these Disney backpacks and Hello Kitty. And I thought, no, those are just from China. That doesn't mean anything. They're not teaching that in school. They're not watching that on television. So, yeah.
I found it kind of creepy in a way that here you have these children that, why don't you talk about that? You were exposed to children and went to some schools and heard some music, and they were curious about you.
Yeah, it depended on the age. You know, I talk about this a lot in the book too. I really gravitate to children when I travel. I really think they're a true barometer of a country, and, you know, they haven't been taught yet to behave a certain way with tourists. And you know, I spend a lot of time at schools and orphanages and that type of thing when I go anywhere. And so I was very excited to see the children in North Korea. And I had loaded up on orphanages and schools and children's palaces. And you know, the experiences in those places were just as weird as everywhere else. They are on message. They did not deviate from the script. So the children's palace, I called it an extracurricular jail. What this is, what was told to me was that any child in the country can go and study whatever they want. What in fact it is that the children of the elite go to these after-school programs. They're assigned whatever it is that they're going to do. So they're going to be a violin player or a calligrapher or an accordion player or whatever the case. And they practice that instrument or sport or whatever every single day for their entire childhood. And then they perform for party members and for tourists. And I imagine they must do well, or there's, you know, some kind of repercussion. So when you arrive at the children's palace, they'll take you into a room and pretend as if these children are spontaneously busting out a tune. Well, in fact, it's, you know, very well rehearsed, and they're child prodigies. Each one is more talented and amazing than the next. So it's depressing because you know that these children have no lives, that all they do is practice the accordion for 5 hours a day after school. On the other hand, there are the rich kids who get to do this instead of being emaciated and, you know, tilling the field. So it's, again, it's this conundrum and this mixed emotion. And I went to one high school, and it was so difficult because it was planted and fake, but then they were answering real questions, so I couldn't really tell what was real and what wasn't real. And I was there with some school teachers from Britain who just happened to be there at the same time, and one was an English teacher. And it was very funny because they were supposedly teaching English that day. We just happened to come into a class, an English class, and the British school teacher couldn't teach the lesson on the board because it was incomprehensible. But, it was definitely, they knew we were coming. There was cameras in the room, and there was probably 15 different handlers and teachers and principals to make sure that nothing went wrong. But on the other hand, they're kids, and, you know, when they were answering real questions, how they could prevent something from being said incorrectly, I don't know. So it seemed like a very unnecessary risk given how tightly they control everything. I had real encounters with some small children who were not yet in the children's party, which are called Young Pioneers, and they were so excited to see me and gathered around me, and that was kind of a unique moment. My fresh handler was really excited by it. She had never seen kids behaving so kid-like. Older handler got mad and made me leave. And every now and then, you know, I would encounter a kid that would stop and stare at me. And that sounds like nothing to people, but in North Korea, that's huge. I mean, that's a giant risk for a child to stop and stare or smile or wave or walk over to me or let me take their picture. It was pretty miraculous, in fact.
Doesn't it make you wonder what their home life is like?
I can't even imagine. You know, I said this when I went to one of the orphanages. I got on the floor to play with the little kids, and none of them would even look at me, you know, or engage in any way. And I think that's pretty basic human behavior, to just at least look up. And that disturbed me a lot, wondering what their lives must be like, that they don't even have that natural reaction to look at a stranger that comes into their environment. You know, or the ability for these 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds not to be at all ruffled when a huge group of people come into the room and they're performing, or, you know, just the, even at the orphanage, again, I think the kids were maybe 3 or 4 years old and they could break into song and dance, like a perfectly choreographed song and dance routine. So, you know, that's not normal.
And they don't know it. Yeah. Your cover photo of the book is of a wedding couple. It actually does express a lot of that. Yeah. Dissonance, where you have a real stuffed bird,
yeah,
and then some stuffed animals,
pilgrims,
as part of the wedding cake or something.
Yeah.
But talk about that experience, and this might have been the first, this experience in the book where you talk about getting the stink eye from people, and
yeah,
it's almost like the only real emotional connection was,
yeah,
through somebody giving you a dirty look.
Let me say first, you know, I've been a lot of places where people don't particularly like Americans, but once they start to talk to you, it changes. They recognize you as a person, or they might not like your religion or whatever the case, but once you have a dialogue, that changes. This was the first place I've been where it does not change. You're an American imperialist, and it doesn't matter what happens. You remain American imperialist.
And they told you.
Oh, they said it to my face. Oh, and they told me to my face. Or they would say, we don't like your country. We don't like your leader. You're okay. But they didn't mean it. They were just trying to be cordial. And so I had been in North Korea a couple of days, and I was starting to catch on to the notion that nothing was going to be real and I was going to get nowhere fast. And older handler was trying to be accommodating. She knew by now I liked to take photos. And she had asked me if I wanted to see a real North Korean wedding, and I thought, fantastic. So it happened, of course, to be a Thursday at 1 o'clock, the wedding, at the same restaurant we were, so I was a little dubious. We managed to stay later at the same restaurant, and when the bride and groom arrived, the guests were all in their work clothes, and no one was dressed for a wedding, and the whole thing was so bizarre, but I was pushed up to the very front to the bridal table and allowed to take the photo, which is the one on the cover. And the bride saw me with my camera standing in front of her and gave me the worst stink eye I have ever had in the world. And I thought, holy cow, that's real. This woman does not want me here or taking her photo. And it started this list I kept in the book of things I might be things that might be real. It's a little more graphically described in the book. You know, and there were moments throughout the trip, many of them were people's emotions showing through. Either they were laughing or found something sarcastic, or, you know, my older handler screamed, "Damn it," when somebody missed a goal at the football game. And, you know, so they that's an important point in the book, is that the North Korean people are different than the North Korean government. And, you know, in the same way that we'll categorize, you know, the Russians as this or the Iranians as that or the Syrians as this, and it's particularly relevant now with the refugee crisis and how we're so dismissive of entire cultures and countries. And, you know, these people were just plumbers and doctors and school teachers before all of this started. And we've lost our empathy for everyone. And it's so awful. And it's very similar in North Korea. You know, these are just people. They were just born in the worst place. And it's so difficult because, yes, the place is ridiculous. The country is insane. But these are just human beings that have their normal lives. You know, they fall in love. They are frustrated at work. They don't do well at school. Anything that you and I experience, they just happen to live there. And so that bride was sort of the first reminder that, you know, how would you feel if some stranger with the camera showed up at your wedding and was taking your picture like you were a zoo animal? So it was a moment that was both refreshing and a good reminder that, you know, they were human too. So, yeah.
I think the book is actually a wonderful expose that is done with a respect for the people who are caught in this situation, who maybe would love to know who Hello Kitty is and wear those backpacks because they're into it.
Yeah.
And that maybe your visit there in a very small way and the book in a very big way will help break some of that down.
I mean, I couldn't ask for more. So,
yes. Yeah. Thank you for coming to visit us.
Thank you.
And
thanks so much for having me on.
This is your first book. You've been blogging, but this is your first book.
Yep.
And keep traveling and keep telling us stories
thanks.
Of your travels.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Wendy E. Simmons, and her book is My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest, Worst Place on Earth. Wendy is a warm and candid photographer. Check her work out online. Earlier, we spoke with Paul H. B. Shin with his novel of espionage, North Korea, and the fear and paranoia that tear people apart. Half-Life. Thank you for listening today. Subscribe to our podcasts and listen when you like. The music today was from David Amram's original score to the 1962 film, The Manchurian Candidate. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a novel idea.